Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Gaza is now the deadliest place on earth to be a journalist. On August 10th, five journalists were killed by the Israeli military. Another five were killed on Monday. At least 247 Palestinian journalists have been killed in Gaza since the October 7th attacks. The Israeli military does not allow outside journalists to enter Gaza. So if it weren't for Palestinian journalists, we would have no idea what's happening on the ground. Here's what happened on Monday. The Israeli military bombed the fourth floor of the Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza. It's the only functioning hospital left in the south. Journalists and rescue workers rushed to the scene, as they always do. They often gather at that spot to get a Wi-Fi connection and do live shots. 8 minutes later, a second strike happened. Reuters reports that the Israeli Defense Forces knew their team was operating from Al-Nasser Hospital. 22 people were killed, including medics, health workers, and five journalists who worked for international media outlets. Miriam Daga was a 33-year-old photographer for the Associated Press. She documented children who were starving and malnourished. Mohammed Salma was a 24-year-old cameraman for Al Jazeera and the Middle East Eye. He was engaged and planned to get married after a ceasefire. Ahmed Abu Aziz was a 29-year-old correspondent with the Middle East Eye. Moaz Abu Taha was a 27-year-old freelance journalist for Reuters. And Hassam Al-Masri was a 48-year-old cameraman for Reuters. The Guardian has a piece about their stories. The Guardian was able to interview some of their family members. Another journalist in Gaza worked on this story, Malak Tantesh. And if you'd like to read that, you can find it at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. The piece talks about their children, their families. One was engaged. Here is Palestinian journalist Hind Khodari, who has been on the ground working for Al Jazeera over the past 2 years doing reporting. And in this clip, she explains why journalists are spending so much time in hospitals.
We do everything. We wear our press jackets, we wear our helmets. We try to not go to anywhere where it's not safe. We try to go to anywhere where to keep our security, but we have been targeted in normal places where normal citizens are. We're trying to do everything, but at the same time, we want to report. We want to tell the world what's going on. It's heartbreaking to report this today, and it's heartbreaking to report Shireen's killing, Hamza's killing, and Samer's killing, and this is not the first time we're doing this, but every time it feels as if it's the first time. It's a great loss for us here, journalists in Gaza, and especially Al Jazeera's team, losing such a colleague.
Al Jazeera has lost 10 journalists, and Hind says the reason why the journalists are in the hospitals is because that's where so much is happening. They're able to interview people. They're able to take photos of people and then get those images and the videos out to the world. Earlier, I spoke with Leila Al-Arian, a Peabody Award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and executive producer of Al Jazeera's flagship U.S. investigative documentary program, Fault Lines. The Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, recently won a Peabody Award. The film follows three Palestinian families in Gaza whose loved ones were killed by the Israeli military. Hi, Leila. Thank you so much for joining us. And I first want to say I'm so sorry about the loss of your colleagues.
Thank you so much, Rose. Thank you for doing this conversation. It's just staggering to think that since Israel began its genocidal assault on Gaza, 10 of my Al Jazeera colleagues have been killed. That number is so difficult for me to comprehend. And it's not just Al Jazeera. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, some 200 journalists have been killed in Gaza. And there's even higher figures coming out of Gaza, where the collecting of the numbers is faster. And just to put that in context, a really important Brown University study came out a few months ago showing that Gaza is by far the deadliest place on earth to be a journalist. Mm. More journalists have been killed in Gaza since the US Civil War, World Wars I and II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the war in Yugoslavia, and Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
I think what's been so hard about this, Layla, is we have been watching this unfold on our screens, sometimes in real time. And I always have to stop and remember that these videos are coming from Palestinians because Israel is still not allowing any outside journalists to enter Gaza. And so we would not know what's happening if it weren't for these Palestinian journalists. And I just want to ask you first, I mean, how are you and your colleagues at Al Jazeera doing after so much loss?
It's really, really emotionally difficult to even comprehend what our colleagues on the ground are going through. I mean, if we all feel so devastated, and I talk to not just Al Jazeera colleagues, but Palestinian journalists and even non-Palestinians who are just deeply moved and impacted by what they're seeing, just based on their sheer humanity. People are saying some days they can barely function. They just can't believe that the world is allowing these atrocities to happen day in and day out. It's something that really, kind of breaks your mind that for years and years, you hear, the West, you hear journalists, human rights advocates, politicians talk about human rights, talk about, the importance of protecting civilians, of following, the so-called rules-based order. And then the genocide of Gaza has just shown that there are some rules for some people to follow. And when it comes to the Israeli state, currently plausibly accused of genocide, there are no rules. They can turn Gaza into a killing cage. They can repeatedly displace people, orphan children, maim people, starve them, and they can do so with impunity and with full support, not just of Western politicians and Western states, but also in many cases, Western media, which is backing them and propagating their talking points.
We'll talk about Western media in a minute, but I want to ask you about some of the journalists and your colleagues that you've lost. Because yesterday we had on a few of the young Palestinians who work with the group, We Are Not Numbers. And they really want to emphasize that we have lives, we have hopes, we have dreams, we have stories. We are human beings, we are not just numbers. And it's so easy just to see these horrific numbers come out. 50,000 dead, 20 killed, five journalists killed. Can you tell us a bit about some of your colleagues? Because I've noticed that a lot of the media outlets aren't even saying their names.
Exactly. And I think it's so important that we say all of their names. I remember watching, the young reporter who was just in his 20s, Ismail Al-Ghul, the day that he was killed. He was doing reports outside of actually Ismail Haniyeh's home after he was killed. So they were actually killed, I believe, on the same day, even. And he was, covering, filming at Ismail Haniyeh's childhood home in Gaza. And I just remember looking at his face and still seeing some baby fat and thinking, wow, he's just so young. He's so young. And then soon after, Israel attacked him with a drone, attacked his car to the point where his head was actually severed from his body. And his beloved colleagues found him. He'd been, like maimed like that, it completely, murdered, beheaded. I think about Anas al-Sharif, only 28 years old. Anas actually was working so much. He was killed on August 10th that days before his murder, he actually asked Al Jazeera for a break. He said, please, I'm so exhausted. And remember, these people are starving, they're displaced, they're enduring everything themselves that they're covering. They've lost loved ones. They don't have offices. They don't have equipment. And Enes actually turned off his phone and took a nap and woke up to hundreds of messages. He was so devoted to his work. He was actually offered a chance to leave Gaza. He was told, if you stop your reporting, we'll actually allow you to leave Gaza. And this is at a time when Gaza's completely shut, shut from both sides. No one is able to leave or come in. But he was apparently given this offer. He said, "No, I'm not going to leave. I have a mission as a journalist, and I'm going to continue the coverage until my last breath." And Enes had two young children who he loved very much. He had a young wife who he loved very much. He loved his work. We're talking about people with extraordinary courage, resilience, and professionalism. Maryam Abu Daqqa was only 33 years old. She had a 12-year-old son who she'd been separated from for a year and a half. He had left Gaza for safety, and she continued pursuing the important work of documenting this genocide. And I can also tell you about Mohammed Salama, another young journalist who met the love of his life, Hala Asfour, during the genocide, another journalist. And Hala talks about how, as a gesture of love, Mohammed stood in line, a very long, exhausting process, just to get her a bag of bread as a gift. And she talked about how, during this famine and starvation, that bread that he got her was the most precious gift. And they barely had any time to enjoy each other, to spend time together, to work side by side, covering the horrors that they documented before he too was stolen from her. He was killed on August 25th, along with Maryam Abu Daqqa, Hussam Al-Masri, Muaz Abu Taha, and Ahmed Abu Aziz. It's important we say their names. I've been very disappointed in seeing some of the organizations, news organizations that these journalists worked for, whether it's the Associated Press or Reuters, not only fail to center their names and to tell us who they are, but also in some cases, actually in the cases of both of them, as well as the New York Times and other legacy media organizations, they actually amplified verifiably wrong and slanderous and defamatory claims by the Israeli military, which we know are false, which are provably false. But they center them, they put them in headlines. This is adding insult to injury. Not only are your own colleagues being mass slaughtered in just stunning, horrific, outrageous numbers that we've never seen before, but oftentimes these same media organizations that depend on their work end up propagating the very lies that Israel basically releases or Israel spews to justify these unjustifiable killings.
Leila, you mentioned that Anas received an offer to stop his reporting and to leave Gaza. Where did that offer come from?
I don't know the exact details. This was something that was reported after his killing by one of his relatives. If I were to guess, it came via the Israelis, who had been threatening him for a very long time, because Israel is the only entity that allows anyone to come in and anyone to leave. No one can do that without the Israelis' permission. Israel had also been threatening Enes for a very, very long time to stop his coverage. They'd also killed his father in December 2023 after deliberately targeting his home, after threatening him. And again, I mean, they are the only ones who determine who comes in and who comes out. So I'm not sure exactly specifically what the source was, but I would imagine that the same source that's threatening him to stop the coverage is probably also making enticing offers.
Right. In July, the Committee to Protect Journalists actually had a story. CPJ calls for Anas al-Sharif's protection in face of Israeli smears. They said, "We are so alarmed by repeated threats made by an Israeli army spokesperson, and we're calling on the international community to protect him." This is from CPJ Regional Director Sarah Kuda. I also want to ask you a question because this hit me really hard. After learning about Anas al-Sharif's father dying in December, I lost my dad in January, and I'm still grieving. I mean, I went to the beach yesterday and I was just in tears because I still can't believe he's gone. It just made me wonder, how are Palestinians grieving?
Palestinians are not only denied the right to live, they're denied the right to grieve. when you're in sheer survival mode, which is what Israel has done to the Palestinians of Gaza in this genocide since the very beginning, cutting off food, water, fuel, repeatedly displacing people, forcing them to live in tents, in unsanitary conditions, in the elements, under the most excruciatingly difficult and painful conditions you can imagine. Everything from, not having soap because they're denying them soap, to not having water, to not having, fruits and vegetables. There are children right now in Gaza who don't know what a fruit and a vegetable look like or taste like, let alone being able to grieve your loved ones because you're constantly in, literally in survival mode, not knowing if you're going to wake up when you go to sleep, not knowing if your home or tent are going to be bombed or your car or you yourself will be attacked by a drone as you're walking, which is what happened to a 16-year-old, distant family member of mine who was simply walking with his father to get food when a drone struck them and killed him on his 16th birthday. No one is safe in Gaza. There is just, so many, there are so many different ways that Israel's killing people, including, as we know well, people who are lining up for food. And it's impossible to truly be able to process all of the horror when you're still going through it. I mean, imagine just what all of this, not just the malnutrition and the being in unsanitary conditions and the destruction of the medical system, the lack of medication, what that does to you physically, but also just the heightened constant stress and being in fight or flight mode. What that does to your nervous system, what that does to you emotionally. Palestinians are so dehumanized that this isn't even in our conversation. Palestinians are reduced to numbers. And even then, you have legacy media that often aids and abets Israel in its propaganda campaign. Palestinians deserve the right to life and to an equal life, just like anybody else. But the deep dehumanization of Palestinians denies them that and seeks to rationalize or justify Israel's violence, which has been directed at Palestinians for a very long time.
Today, we're speaking with Leila Al-Aryan, a Peabody Award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and executive producer of Al Jazeera's flagship U.S. investigative documentary program, Fault Lines. The Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, recently won a Peabody Award. The film follows three Palestinian families in Gaza whose loved ones were killed by the Israeli military. I've been also wondering, Leila, and I wonder what you are hearing from your colleagues working at legacy media outlets. Why hasn't there been more of an effort to try to get into Gaza? Why haven't international journalists gone to Egypt or Israel en masse, let's say 15, 20 of them, and say, let us in? Why hasn't that happened?
It's a good question. I think that's a question for newsroom leaders to answer. I think what has happened is journalists have gone in with the Israeli military on these choreographed, completely controlled embed missions into Gaza, which of course is not independent journalism. You're acting essentially at the behest of the Israeli military. And oftentimes the stories that come out of those embeds are just stenography. Whatever the Israeli military tells you, you publish. Whatever the Israeli military lets you see, you write about. But you're not actually independently reporting from there. There needs to be much more, action when it comes to journalists demanding that they be let into Gaza. But it's very clear that Israel doesn't want them to see their war of annihilation of the Palestinian people. When you have newborn babies sniped in the head while breastfeeding, do you really want international media to report on that? Look at what doctors who are going into Gaza are reporting back. Every single doctor who's gone into Gaza has come back and said, I've been to every war zone. I report, I w normally work in an ER in a large urban city where we get gunshot wounds, or I've been to every single, disaster site in my career. I've never seen anything like this. Every single one of them comes back saying, This is hell on earth. We've never seen anything like this. This is a war on children. This is a war on civilians. This is horrifying. And what happens? Israel then denies them entry, just like they did with Dr. Mimi Sayed just this week. Dr. Mimi has been a very outspoken doctor. She's American. She went to Gaza twice. She just tried to go back a third time. They denied her. They don't want eyewitnesses to their genocide. And that is the main reason why they're not letting in foreign journalists. And it's why they're annihilating journalists on the ground in Palestine. And I want to say this is not just about killing the eyewitnesses, those who are documenting the genocide, but it's also about killing potential witnesses in court tribunals, which is what needs to happen. Israel has to be put on trial for these war crimes and crimes against humanity. And who better to testify against them than these journalists who are documenting these war crimes? Mohammed Salama, who I mentioned earlier, who met the love of his life during this genocide, just got married and was killed on August 25th. He actually reported out of the Nasser Medical Complex, Nasser Hospital, where for many, many, many months he refused to leave. He reported on people coming in, who were injured or killed. And he also reported on the multiple raids and attacks by the Israeli military against that hospital. We know this is also unprecedented when you look at this genocide of Gaza, which is Israel's attacks on the medical system there, healthcare workers, its arrest and killing and targeting of healthcare workers as well as healthcare facilities. And Mohammed never wavered in his coverage, stayed and continued covering it. And it's no coincidence that in this double tap strike, we should mention they first attacked the Reuters camera and the Reuters journalist. And when the colleagues went to go check on him and see what happened, as well as the civil defense workers who responded, they attacked again. This is not a coincidence. It's not a mistake. And it's not an accident. This is intended to silence the coverage as well as the witnesses in any future proceedings.
Well, and to your point, I was watching NBC when this happened, and Molly Hunter, an NBC reporter, said that the drone targeted the staircase at the hospital. It is widely known that Palestinian journalists gather in that staircase to get a Wi-Fi to do their live shots.
Exactly. This was clearly a targeted attack. And rather than show outrage and grief and, utter horror at what happened, what we ended up seeing is legacy media like Reuters, like AP, like the New York Times publishing the absurd Israeli claims that what they intended to attack was a Hamas camera, when in fact everybody knew the camera that they were looking at that they claimed was a Hamas camera was in fact the Reuters and AP live feed where they report out of. So it's absurd. It's a patent lie. And unfortunately, it's just regurgitated and seeks to just justify the unjustifiable. The number of civilians killed, just the other day, an investigation by 972 magazine and The Guardian revealed that according to Israel's own figures, which I think is probably a conservative number, 83% of those killed in Gaza are civilians. Staggering number that only compares to genocides like the Rwanda genocide, the genocide of Srebrenica in Bosnia. That number blows everything else out of the water when you look at actual conflicts.
Where does this go? I mean, how much longer can this last?
I don't know. I mean, that's a question that people in Gaza are asking every single day. They're exhausted. They're collapsing on the street from malnutrition. They're tired of being forced out of wherever they've made a home. Usually it's a tent now. To be ordered by the Israeli military to leave time and time again. People have had it. They're completely depleted. They're grieving. They're being, the impact of the chemicals in the air from all the toxic weapons being fired at them. People are getting sick. There's no medication. If you're a diabetes patient, if you're a cancer patient, whatever, chronic illnesses people are facing, there's no treatment right now. It's just beyond description. And enough is enough. There needs to be pressure by people on the West, on their governments, to make them stop this. Because Israel's only able to do this because of the support of the United States and European countries, but especially the United States. 70% of Israel's weapons being used in Gaza come from the United States. So as Americans, it's up to people to say, stop the slaughter that's being done with our tax money and with weapons that our own country provides.
Leila Al-Aryan is a Peabody Award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and executive producer of Al Jazeera's flagship U.S. investigative documentary program, Fault Lines. On Wednesday, police arrested 138 Jewish Voice for Peace protesters who occupied the offices of Senator Alex Padilla's office in San Francisco. Jewish Voice for Peace protesters also were in San Diego, Sacramento, and at Senator Adam Schiff's office in Los Angeles. Last month, California Senators Padilla and Schiff voted against Bernie Sanders' resolution to stop weapon sales to Israel. Two dozen Democrats voted in favor of the resolution. Here is Senator Padilla asked about Gaza on Meet the Press 3 weeks ago.
All right, I have to ask you about the hunger crisis in Gaza, turning to overseas. Last year, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, charging him with war crimes for, quote, starvation as a method of warfare, among other charges. I have to ask you, Senator, do you believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed war crimes?
Yeah. Well, look, the situation in Gaza is absolutely heartbreaking, and it truly is a humanitarian crisis. So Israel needs to do more, and the United States, the Trump administration, can and should do more to address that, absolutely.
But do you think that he's committed war crimes?
Well, let the experts conduct their research investigation and reach those conclusions. Again, what's happening in Gaza is heartbreaking. We need to be doing more, but addressing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and Israel's right to defend itself are not mutually exclusive.
You're saying the U.S. has to do more. More than half of your caucus this week, a record number, voted to block sales to some weapons to Israel. You did not, though, Senator. Why do you think the U.S. should keep sending weapons to Israel? And does that undercut your message that the U.S. should do more?
No, I don't think it does. I think we should actually focus on the humanitarian piece and move not just resolutions, but policy and investments accordingly. What the resolution spoke to is much broader than just Israel and Gaza and those negotiations, because as you know, Israel's under constant threat from Hamas still, from Hezbollah, from the Houthis, from Iran on a more broader level. And so we need to try to do what we can to maintain the security and stability of the region and address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
That was Senator Alex Padilla on Meet the Press 3 weeks ago. Coming up after a break, we'll speak with Shirouk Assad, a veteran journalist based in the West Bank. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and now we would like to welcome Shirouk Assad, a veteran journalist based in the West Bank. Shirouk Assad is founder and director of the Palestine Journalism Hub, a correspondent for MCD Radio, and project manager for Women in News Palestine. Hi, Shirouk. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Shirouk, you've really dedicated so much of your career to empowering Palestinian journalists and students through training and networking opportunities. Your Twitter feed is full of photos of young Palestinian journalists who've lost their lives. How are you processing all of this, to think that almost 250 young Palestinian journalists have been killed and so close to you?
Yeah, very close. I have to tell you that I was calling, talking to my colleagues just now before I was with you. And Israel has decided to stop any aid through planes. Usually Jordan does this, and the United Emirates. They are surrounding Gaza City. Gaza City has 1 million Palestinians there. Who came back, you know, just only months ago, many months ago, you know, after they've been displaced for several times. They are terrified. They have elderly, they have their mothers, some are sick with no medication. They have children. They are starved since more than 6 months now. And yes, my heart is full of my colleagues' pictures and stories. Some who left their children behind with no one to take care of them. Some were really waiting for years to pass and see them maybe in universities. It's heartbreaking to see them, to lose those journalists one after the other. And now I'm talking to you, and in a month we'll be closing 2 years of this genocide. I listened to them today. A colleague told me, I see myself in in all cases. I see myself killed. I see myself without arms. I see myself blind. I see myself dying from starvation. I see myself in all the cases, because really anything can happen. And I also want to say something before I continue to the senator who was talking before me. Mm-hmm. Who was a bit terrified addressing this genocide clearly, the way the United States and Europe addressed what happened in Ukraine, though really not even 10% as a human issue happened in there. We talk about nearly 70,000 Palestinians between dead and under the rubbles and injured. We talk about 14,000 children killed. We talk about 14,000 women. We talk about more than 600 of doctors, all the universities demolished, all the hospitals. So he was talking that it is a humanitarian issue. We need to talk about aid and so on. No, it's not a humanitarian issue. It is occupation that has been going with the aid and the help and the support of the United States since 77 years. I am the third generation of those refugees, and my parents lost their village in Jerusalem, and we became all refugees. This is not only an issue of flour and clean water. It is important, but this should be a right, not something that a place like United States that talks about freedoms and human rights and lectured us for years and years and years about all this now become part of this genocide. I wish we will not really lose another child or another man or another family. I wish that we will save the lives of my colleagues, because you are a journalist, I am a journalist, we have a duty, we do our job. They were the 12 that we lost the last past week only. They were near the hospitals, in the hospitals, with their cameras, with their vests, with their helmets, and they were bombed. And things are just moving in the world, as if we are normalizing and people are normalizing with this death, and an assassination, in my opinion. And anyway, here in the West Bank also, it's not something very easy to live by settlers, by soldiers backing them up, by more than nearly 1,000 military checkpoint around our villages and the cement wall and the settlements. So yes, I see them, I see their eyes, I see their families, and we are all in pain, and I think we are all feeling injustice. And I cannot imagine, we are still trying to tell the world that we exist and that we have the same right as yours, no matter where will you be in this world, and that we are all human beings. What you want for yourself, you have to want it really for me, and my colleagues' lives are so precious, so precious. Maybe you can ask me, because I will go on talking about their situation for hours without internet, without electricity, with fear, with trauma, with loss, nonstop, really. So if you have anything to ask, I'm ready. I'm here to try to deliver their voice.
Thank you, Shahrukh. I just wonder, how far are you from Gaza City?
1 hour by car.
Wow. And what would happen?
And we cannot go.
And how are, what would happen if you tried to get into Gaza?
No way, because anyways, to go out of Ramallah or Jerusalem, you will pass like two checkpoints. And then you will reach to a very big checkpoint, Erez checkpoint, which is totally, totally closed with tanks and soldiers. No one is allowed to get in to cover, though it is my right to cover the story. I cannot cover the story. The village near me, yani 2 days ago, the settlers attacked Al-Mughayyir village in Ramallah. They burned 300 olive trees. They burned it all. This is the trees that are thousands of years old and that the families live from. They just burnt it, and soldiers were there, did nothing. I could not go film and do my story. It's only 15 minutes from my home. Israel, yani, the GPO, the governmental Israeli governmental press office, said, I think the end of 2024, this was their number, 4,000 international journalists were banned to enter, who applied. Some even were not allowed to reach the airport or to cross the bridge, Lembi Bridge, between Jordan and here. So imagine it's more and more. And now those journalists, I see them, and I saw them 2 days in Jerusalem. Some work for American media, some European. They are even terrified to move in West Bank to film. Yani, what situation we are in, even if you post or deliver and they don't really like you, they can, any minute, I have this fear every night that any minute the soldiers will invade my home and just take me for what I'm saying now to you. Because we have nearly 200 of our colleagues who are arrested since the genocide started. And we know nothing about them except from people who get out of the prison. Red Cross cannot visit them. Also, there is starvation. They all went out from the jails, losing 20 and 30 kilos of their weight, even for 3-4 months. Torture, sexual harassment, no medication for them. Nobody can visit them. So we are living as if we are not in this planet. We are not in any human planet, in my opinion. We are left alone, my colleagues and the families are left alone in Gaza to face their destiny. And you could not imagine what does it mean that you are a journalist in a tent, known you are a journalist, near a hospital, and a huge missile falls on your body, on the tent.
It's so hard to comprehend. Today, we're speaking with Shahrukh Assad, a veteran journalist based in the West Bank, founder and director of the Palestine Journalism Hub, correspondent for MCD Radio, project manager for Women in News Palestine. She has worked, really dedicated her career to empowering Palestinian journalists, and almost 250 have been killed in Gaza. Shahrukh, what do you think explains why we're not hearing more from Western journalists? Why aren't they demanding to get in? Why aren't they speaking up more? What explains this? What are you hearing from them?
To be frank, I don't want to know why. I'm tired and I don't want to know why. As a Palestinian and as a journalist, this was the situation of Western, especially mainstream media, all over this occupation, but I never thought that they will go on like this after what they see in Gaza. Of course, I have to say thank you for so many of my colleagues, international journalists, who stood up and tried really to go to the streets, to push their newsrooms or directors or politicians. But they are not so many. Yani, imagine last week, Hussam, I can't remember his family name, and Maryam Abu Daqqa, they work, Hussam works for Reuters, and Maryam works with Associated Press. Can you imagine that when I read what they wrote, the article was full of the explanation and justification of Benjamin Netanyahu and the army about this killing, and they were asking the Israel for more information, and they were calling them contractors, those journalists who stayed, even if they were freelancers. Because even the international media, if everybody knows, they asked anybody to leave Gaza from their like people who work with them permanently, staff, I mean. So who stayed in as our eyes and our ears or our senses, they are the local journalists, those young journalists. They did not say anything. It was very, very injustice for me, for my colleagues, because they paid their life to deliver this story. I don't know why they are not standing up. I don't know if this happens in, for example, let's switch it. If Palestinians are doing this to Israelis, will it be the same reaction? If Russia is doing this to Ukrainian, to Ukraine, the action will be the same. I think it has to do, I don't know, maybe it has been years of disinformation in the West about Palestine. No reference to our occupation and our displacement and our misery. And there's that even journalists are not, they are becoming spokespeople for IDF, for Israeli army, and for their politicians. Nobody is doing the ethical journalism or even pushing. Even here in Jerusalem, there's the FPA, the Foreign Press Association, and I met with them. They are afraid even to go on a panel. There was a panel months ago with our colleagues in Gaza to say that it is important to let journalists in. They refused to join.
You know, you mentioned the journalists who were killed on Monday, and I read their names and read a little bit about them in the introduction. And I just want to again highlight, so I just learned about this, another young Palestinian, a woman journalist in Gaza, Malak Tantesh. She's writing for The Guardian, and she has a remembrance piece about these journalists. And I Shahrukh, I think that this really takes othering to a new level when we're talking about this, because when you look at these lives, and you can't even, I mean, we can't even imagine to be in a tent, to have to go to a hospital to get a Wi-Fi connection, to plug in your computer under these conditions, also trying to find food. In one of your tweets, you have a photo of a journalist who fainted. So I just want to read a little bit just to let people know who these journalists were. Maryam Daka, 33-year-old photographer for the AP. And again, these words are from Malak Tantesh, a Palestinian journalist in Gaza. Miriam's photography.
He has only son. And I'm sorry, I have to say this because the night before she was bombed, I was trying to deliver some flour for my colleagues, and they delivered some flour for her, and she was waiting till the morning to come to be able to do some bread for her only child.
Well, according to this piece, her photography highlighted the human suffering in Gaza with pictures depicting starving children and people grieving their loved ones after Israeli strikes. Her reports for the AP covered the plight of malnourished children in Nasser Hospital, where she was killed. And then, as you mentioned, her son, she left behind a letter for her son. "You are my love, my heart, my support, my soul, and my son, who I am always proud of." I mean, there's so many stories. Mohammed Salama, 24-year-old cameraman for Al Jazeera. On his birthday, he became engaged to fellow journalist Hala Asfor. They were planning their wedding to be held after the ceasefire, and he was the 10th Al Jazeera journalist killed. So Al Jazeera has lost 10 journalists.
Yes. And of course, you have to say, but because lives are more important, we don't talk about offices. Al Jazeera office, AP, AFP, Reuters, all were bombed. 112 media offices, homes. Yes, Al Jazeera paid the biggest price, starting from my dear friend Shireen Abu Akleh till now. Yes, they are the 10th journalists killed.
And I just wonder, how, I keep asking, how much longer can this last? Where does this go? I just want to read a couple news pieces that just came out and get your thoughts. Reuters has a piece, the United States is denying and revoking visas from members of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestine Authority ahead of the UN General Assembly meeting in September, according to the State Department. There's a piece from Axios, Inside Trump's Gaza Meeting with Tony Blair and Jared Kushner. On Wednesday, Trump discussed a quote, post-war plan for Gaza involving Kushner and Tony Blair. They were also with Israeli official Ron Dermer. Dermer told the officials Israel does not want to occupy Gaza long term, but needs an acceptable alternative to Hamas to govern. Kushner and Blair got Trump's blessing to keep developing a plan. Right now, they don't have an answer as to who would take over. What do you make of all of this?
It's very clear. It's very clear to me, and we know it. The United States is partner with Israeli army in this genocide, and United States is backing Israel, and United States that consider itself the biggest state of freedoms and human rights is banning a president of a state that United States itself signed an agreement with in Oslo to do two-state solution, and they did not do anything till now. Can you imagine this? It's in my opinion, Israel is doing everything in coordination with the United States. Nothing. If Trump wants to stop the war now, they will stop it now. He will stop it now. He doesn't want to stop the war. There is a plan for all the Middle East that is done, but the highest price is paid by Gaza and by the Palestinians. But the thing that you are reading now, it should draw a light for every American and everybody in the world that we are in our lowest levels of humanity and freedom of speech. And it will not only be for Palestinians, no, everybody in the world will really suffer from this. In my opinion, freedom of speech in the United States is not in its good terms. Look what's happening to students in universities, to even in Europe. It's not because it's not only an attack on Palestinians or on Palestinian journalism scene. It should be seen, if we are human beings, this is an attack on humanity, on our humanity, and on our all ethical journalism scene. We will all pay the price. It's very dangerous what we are facing. Maybe we are facing it, or our colleagues under bombs, but it's done other ways all over the world. It's a plan that is moving on. Leaders are the United States and Israel, and it makes me angry and it makes me sad to hear those words from a state like United States that says that it's with human rights, because no, they are not with human rights. If anybody wants to be with human rights, and I say this always, I don't want anybody to be with Palestine, but I want them to be with human rights they say they belong to, and the international law.
Sharouk, you reminded me of a comment I heard. There were journalists in London holding a memorial service for the Palestinian journalists who were killed. One of the speakers says that this sets a very bad precedent. It will allow a state to kill journalists with impunity.
Yeah, but I have to tell you that even the presidents before weren't much better. And they were saying nice words on the screens, but under the table, the war started not when Trump came, it was before. And our occupation lasted for 77 years for other presidents. But it's deteriorating. You know what I mean? Like every time it's something worse and something worse and something worse, and we are all losing it.
So Shahrukh, we have about a minute left. What ultimately is going to happen to Gaza and the Palestinians who live there?
If I want to be frank, I'm not optimistic. I think that this will go on, and I don't think there will be... There is Gaza in our hearts, and we know it. There is Palestine that we belong to. There is our identity. But I think Israel and the United States are going to the end of this to maybe let people out as much as they can, control the land, do whatever projects they want, and even teach everybody who wants to speak about freedoms and humanity a lesson, not to speak and not to stand against the projects and just be silent and that's it. Or what happens to Gaza can be, Israel should be in the plan, the controller and the president of all the Middle East. This is the plan, actually. I don't think it will be in good place. And sadly, I say this, even the West Bank, what we are seeing daily, no, we are not. We will have years to come, very hard years. Unless, I don't know, somebody speaks, pressures, I don't know. But we're not in good days or years.
Shahrukh Assad is a veteran journalist based in the West Bank, founder and director of the Palestine Journalism Hub, correspondent for MCD Radio, and project manager for Women in News Palestine. Shahrukh, thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and for delivering the story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for helping to produce today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And I hope you can read the piece I mentioned by Malek Tantesh. He loved his work deeply, the five Palestinian journalists killed in Gaza airstrike. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.